Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, what is up? Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host... I should have looked at my M adjective website.
Like a daily calendar with M words.
We'll go with magnanimous Max Montana. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well.
So today we're going to be answering some of you, the fans, questions that we took over Instagram. So today's episode of The Jug Life is brought to you by Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission free. So the first thing we want to get into, and had several people post something to the effect of this, is what's the deal with all this USAPL IPF drama? So if you follow such fine informational pages,
not meme accounts,
as Strength Insider, or such fine meme pages as the Frustrated Strength Coach, which is also the number one source for all your CWS memes. you probably saw a lot of stuff about the cease and desist letter that the IPF sent to USA Powerlifting in regards to their drug testing. You can find it online and read it for yourself, either on Instagram or Reddit or a variety of other places. And now that the USAPL leadership, Dr. Larry Maley, has posted, sort of their response to it thus far. So this is something, the gist of it is the IPF telling the USAPL that their drug testing program is unsanctioned, essentially. Yeah, not that it's fraudulent or wrong or something like that, but that it's not in compliance with WADA. And this is all kind of part of the bigger part of the IPF pretending like the IOC knows who they are, gives a shit about it, where I'm sure if the IPF called the IOC on the telephone, the IOC would be like, The IP, what? Who is this calling? That they don't know who it is. It's not going to be in the Olympics, but that's a topic for another day. So really what they're complaining about is that the USAPL has conducted a ton of drug testing that wasn't through WADA-accredited labs. And Max and I have both been involved in the USAPL and hosted meets and done all that. So at every meet... Every USAPL meet, every local meet, as a meet director, you are required to test 10% of the competitors. So we hosted several meets at Juggernaut with, 100, 120 lifters, and we were testing, 10 to 12 people at each of those. And every weekend, as you look at the USAPL calendar, there's, 4 or 5 meets going on, probably, somewhere between 200 and 500 lifters competing in any given weekend, so 20 to 50 people are getting drug tested. But those drug tests are happening not in the most official way. And not that there's anything like nefarious going on about them, but judges, USAPL judges who are not certified or whatever through WADA are collecting the samples, and then the meat directors are sending them in. So, there can be some question of chain of custody and all that. So, Max, you've been involved, with Alyssa and everyone in this big, very, very official drug testing situations at like IWF Worlds or something. Tell them a little bit about that process.
Yeah, the process for USOC and IOC WADA testing is way more comprehensive and way different than the way the USAPL runs it. So you know, if you're a USAW lifter, you go to World Championships, anything IWF or USOC or IOC, the WADA test is one where you're going to go into a room, there's going to be a bunch of officials in there, there'll be an official drug tester. The drug tester is not allowed to touch any of the equipment, not personal equipment, not your genitals, but not allowed to touch any of the actual...
They can touch your genitals as much as they want, right?
Yeah.
Free for all.
They have to hold it, which... No, they...
Can you shake that last drop off for me?
It's a very different kind of drug test. No, so they give you, like, a box with, you know, like the Behringer...
The Icarus bottle.
The Icarus bottle, right? That is apparently tamper-resistant, but not so. And so what that happens is, you know, you have all this equipment. Only the person giving their urine sample is allowed to touch it. There's about 10 different times you have to write down a serial number, initial things, sign it. You, as the athlete, take all those samples and put them into a box, seal the box, seal an envelope. Everything is done by you, and that's to prevent any possible contamination from the tester or from, you know, a nefarious person hiding deep in the shadows to swap your urine sample out.
And I know, like, Marissa's done this level of WADA testing a couple occasions within USAPL IPF stuff, and I know that that's the one happening because it takes forever.
Yes, forever.
And it's very annoying
when
I want to go eat after the meet, but we have to take hours for drug testing.
They even, like, you know, like a out-of-competition test, they'll come in, do the exact same process. They'll do, like, a specific gravity to make sure urine isn't too diluted. Versus USAPL, where I walk into the bathroom with a gentleman and just watch him pull out his penis and pee into a cup.
Are you sure that was a USAPL meet? Not just a regular Thursday afternoon?
I just gave him a coffee cup. Fill it up. No, and so it's a totally different standard. You can tell the difference is significant. So I can see that's where, you know, the discrepancy between WADA and what USAPL is doing.
And, of course, this WADA testing process is very expensive. And as, you know, USAPL meet directors, as coaches of world team athletes, we're already spending quite a bit of money on drug testing. Like, you know, as a meet director, you would have to buy all the tests, which is $75 per test, but these WADA tests are, you know, people saying thousands of dollars, you know, to be a part of the IPF world team for the U.S. I believe last year our team fee was $375,
jeez.
I think.
It was, huh?
And that's all supposed to be going towards drug testing. So, you know, on one hand, the USAPL is trying to do what they feel is best, and that they're trying to drug test as many people and as frequently as possible in an effort for drug-free sport. And I think that they do that very effectively. They catch a lot of people. Every local meet that we hosted, we caught people. You know? And some of that may have been that, you know, as veterans of that side of the sport, I knew what to look for. But so they're being effective, but the IPF is not happy about it. So, you know, to cut through all this stuff, what's going to be the result of it? You know, there's talk of the USAPL leaving the IPF or the IPF banning them from international competition if they don't comply. I don't foresee either of those things happening.
Yeah.
You know, the USAPL is the most significant part of the IPF, from membership, from notoriety, from all that kind of stuff. So I can't see the IPF being like, no, you guys are, get out of here. Yeah, so are they going to have to stop doing some of the testing that they're doing? Sure. And to be fair, I don't think that that's really that big of a deal.
Yeah.
That a lot of the testing that was being done is unnecessary. So part of the USAPL's rationale behind wanting to test so many people is one, they want to create a level playing field so that people who compete in their federation can, with as much confidence as possible, say, you know, I am drug-free competing against other drug-free lifters. And I think that's an admirable an admirable thing. The second part of wanting to do a lot of the drug testing is trying to catch U.S. lifters internally before they get to an IPF meet,
right,
and test positive there on the world stage, because that has some ramifications. And I think it was 2017, you saw quite a bit of that happening, particularly junior lifters, bench-only lifters going to Worlds, lifting and testing positive there on the international stage.
Yeah. Of course it's the bench-only guys.
Yeah, and with that came some fines, I believe, for the USAPL. Some talk of, well, the USAPL is going to be restricted from international competition, which didn't happen because, again, the IPF doesn't actually care about that, and this isn't unique to the IPF. The USOC doesn't actually care about any of this shit either. They just care about the perception of it. So, anyways, they're trying to stop people from getting on to international teams and testing positive. Now, let's say that the drug tests that the USAPL conduct for the most part right now costs $100, and the WADA ones cost $1,000. So, yeah, and those aren't exact numbers by any stretch, but for the sake of this example, right now the USAPL through the local meets and stuff is conducting, you know, hundreds if not thousands of those tests every year. But a lot of those people who are getting tested, it doesn't matter. Like, we caught people at local USAPL meets, and that's all well and good. But them winning best lifter at the local meet, like, yeah, maybe they won, you know, free supplements that the second place person didn't get, but they're not getting on a world team. They're not setting records that count. And to be fair, no one gives a shit.
Right.
The only real takeaway from those people testing positive at a local meet is that that person is a piece of shit. You know? They're trying to cheat it, like this rinky-dink kind of system, and then failed to do so. But in the effort to test a broad scope of the athletes to be able to say, you know, it's drug free sport and everyone to have confidence in that, if they have to buy $1,000 tests, they just can't test that many people.
Yeah.
So then it becomes an issue of testing the people that matter to the bigger IPF scheme. And that's just very few of the lifters, you know, not to say that their lifting isn't important to them or they're not trying their best and all that kind of stuff. But in the grand scheme of IPF lifting, and I always laugh when I see, you know, people who post on the internet about, like, oh, the IPF is such a scam. Like, it's not for the lifters. I would never compete there. Well, good, because you didn't have to fucking worry about it, because you could never make the meets. You can never make the IPF meets anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's a pretty small pool of lifters who have legitimate chances to lift in IPF competition, and they're the ones who need to get those bigger tests, those more expensive tests. So that would mean, basically, at Nationals, which is the qualifying process for IPF Worlds, test all the winners, because they're the people who are going to eventually make up your IPF World team. And then, you know, 6 weeks out or 8 weeks out, whatever, from Worlds, whatever the threshold of time is for them to be able to get the results of the test back, the smallest threshold that can be, if they get the test results back 2 weeks after the test, then 3 weeks out from IPF Worlds, test everyone who's on the team. And if that's still too cost prohibitive, test everyone who's on the open team.
Yeah.
Not sub-juniors, not juniors, not masters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. Test the open team. That is the real deal. That is if, you know, in this pipe dream, you know, faux attempt to go to the Olympics, which, again, it's not really going to happen. It's never going to happen. But as they continue to want to perpetuate that, the only people that matter in that are the open team. You know, the juniors, the sub-juniors and juniors will eventually matter to it, but they're there more as hobbyists. Everyone is doing it as their hobby. No one is making their living from lifting an IPF competition. But the sportsmen, the professional sportsmen, are the open team. The masters lifters are very impressive. The juniors and sub-juniors are very strong. You know, but the people who matter to the drug testing are the open lifters. So if it's so cost prohibitive that you can't test all of the sub-junior, junior, open, and masters teams, then just test the open team.
Yeah, it's funny because it's really poor allocation of resources to test at local meets at all, because it's irrelevant if you're catching people at that level because it has no impact beyond that. And then not setting up a standardized, you know, hey, top 10 or top 15 or whatever it is, top 20 potential world team members, and setting up, like you said, a timeline where, I mean, just the process by which qualification happens for Worlds is already kind of skewed enough where your Raw Nationals is so far out that you could potentially pass tests there and then not do anything for months and be, you know, I don't think anyone USAPL really is doing that. But taking drugs between then and then the Worlds, where you don't have to actually do a single meet between there. You want to catch more people, you have to host more events. If you host more events, or the events are closer, you set yourself up to have a position where you're making a little bit more money because you have a couple more big meets. Use that money to test the top people, the only people that really matter, in the sense that if they fail a test, it reflects poorly on you. And then you have a situation where you can actually use WADA testing because you have some more finances for it. Rather than passing that cost off, you know, passing that cost on to the lifter too, which is kind of ridiculous to require that they're paying for testing that isn't even necessarily, you know, gonna do them any good in the end anyways, right?
Yeah. So, you know, what is all this gonna mean? Yeah, maybe in the long run it means some less drug testing within the USAPL, which is really a bad move by the IPF.
Yeah.
Like, the USAPL is catching the most people. They have, you know, the most members and all that. But they're trying to do their best. And in doing so, helping stop lifters in the U.S. from getting to international competition by being on drugs. Because just the threat of the test exists. And I'm sure that, you know, people are listening and they're like, well, those drug tests are so easy to pass anyways.
It's just an IQ test.
Yeah. They're not. That's why people get caught doing it. People who I guarantee are smarter than you, you know.
There, like, was a whole nation that was doing this for 40 years and they got caught.
they're getting caught. They're not that easy to pass. And as I've made this point many times before, what the fuck would be the point of trying to lift in the USAPL and IPF and trying to beat the drug tests? Like, it's a pain in the ass to lift there. The meets are more expensive. They're in shitty places. They're judged really strictly. So why would you go to all this trouble anyways? So from the USA Powerlifting, the response, a couple highlights here. We state strongly, USA Powerlifting will not cease our business practices. We'll continue to drug test at every level to maintain the drug-free platform you deserve. And despite asking several times of the IPF, USA Powerlifting has not been provided the alleged WADA complaint, and therefore we will not act upon their cease and desist letter without due process according to the IPF Constitution. So all this stuff is really just kind of much ado about nothing.
Yeah.
I think even depending on what comes out of that in the long term, all this shit will, you know, it'll be appeals and so long, take so long to go through any process. So I don't really foresee anything changing. And, you know, it's rare for me to say this, but I think good on USAPL here by sticking by their mission, which is to provide, you know, drug-free platform for the lifters. And I think that that's commendable. And maybe even though the IPF doesn't think they were going about that the right way, I think they've been doing it with good intentions. So
I feel like we've just got back on USAPL's good side after that one podcast we made.
Yeah. All right. So moving on to more drug-related stuff. Oh, always one of our favorite topics. But our first question from Instagram last night was from @theswolsens, and he says, "My question is controversial." Well, uh-oh, that caught my eye, sir. When it comes to bodybuilding, it's easier to see which competitors are using drugs and who isn't. But in powerlifting, it's more difficult because the strength, you know, someone could be very strong but not necessarily look like it. So that being said, what point does it become obvious that someone is using drugs?
I know. They're on the podium.
Yeah, when they're better, whenever they're stronger than you are, that's when they're using drugs. Yeah, so you know, this is certainly not be all and end all statements in regards to this stuff, and I don't fancy myself to be a pharmacological expert or anything there, but I've been on all the different sides of this that there is to be on, and I think have some at least good anecdotal perspective. So a lot of people, when they're making their fake natty clickbait videos, you know, there's, well, this person has a receding hairline and you know, they have too much fat-free mass or whatever. Those indications, though, can have some merit, for the most part, are pretty weak. Just because of genetic variation in the world. There are freakish natural athletes in the world. And if all that you've ever been exposed to as an athlete, and I'm making air quotes around that, is like powerlifting and, you know, watching YouTube videos, you have no idea the type of athletes that exist in the world.
That is very true.
You know, that what some people are capable of because, you know, they got blessed by genetics when they were born. They picked their parents so incredibly well. So those physical characteristics can be indicative when you see things like, you know, significant changes in jaw shape or hairline, particularly for female athletes and deepening of the voice and that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's certainly worth paying attention to. Just looking at a given performance result, this person is so strong, so fast, that's a pretty shitty way to do it. Especially in powerlifting, because the talent pool is very, very small. It is a small, small sport in the grand scheme of world athletics. So it makes it much easier for a genetic, you know, outlier, just a true physical specimen, to come through and produce results that make people think this person must be on drugs. And I'll talk about that a bit more in a second. So just the results in and of themselves aren't great, but something that it takes a little bit more attention to detail to see is performance trends in an athlete or group of athletes, that can be more telling if you know what you're looking at. So IWF Worlds, 2018 IWF Worlds just came and went, and we talked in our IWF Worlds recap episode last week about, you know, these hugely reduced results for the Russian lifters, the Kazakh lifters, you know, compared to their normal standard, compared to what they did at the Olympics in 2016 or 2015 Worlds, more so. That kind of thing, you see, you know, people going up 4 or 5 kilos in body weight into the new weight classes, and their results going down 20 or 30 kilos, like, that's pretty telling. On a more granular scale, if you pay attention, you know, to results of a lot of lifters and you watch their training, or at least what they share of their training on Instagram, and then the results of competition, over time you can start to observe some probably very telling trends.
I think that one thing that's kind of that needs a little bit of attention when you talk about training too is, if you imagine a situation where a lifter is brand new and they escalate their training, they go from training once or twice a week, or they're new and they ramp up and they make a lot of progress, that's a normal scenario. If you see lifters who have been training extremely hard for a long time, but they continue to increase and continue to make progress despite already being at this point where they're making a, you know, they're at the limit of their, you know, they're basically training to their MRV most of the time. They're at this point where they're able to hit that number, but their progress is continually steady and linear. It's something has to be happening there for that to happen, where the amount of progress they're making is proportional, you know, year after year after year, rather than that progress becoming smaller and smaller. people can make progress when they change things or they increase training significantly, do different kinds of things, change the style of training or coaching or whatever it is. But when you see a sort of a linear progress that continues to grow despite them being at the essentially the limit of what they're able to do, you have to start to, you know, raise his eyebrows, right? If you had a lifter who was, you know, quick to rise to certain results and then continued on beyond that point, something would be up, rather than a lifter who quickly rises to a certain level and then starts to slow down in progress and starts to see not say a plateau, but smaller increases proportionally.
Yeah, so as we're looking at these performance trends, I think the simplest one to observe is big training results compared to poor meet results. So if you watch lifters on Instagram and they're PRs throughout the whole training cycle, and they get to a competition and do poorly. When that happens one time, sure, people have bad meets. You know, you can, if it's happening multiple times, it's like, well, are they cutting a lot of weight to make their weight class? So they're training really, you know, maybe they're training 4 or 5 kilos over their weight class and then having the huge results there, and then they cut and can't reproduce them. Certainly that's a possibility. Is it a bad peaking strategy that the training has a poor design to it? That's a possibility. Is it a mental thing where the person has all this anxiety towards competition? So that's why they can't recreate those training results on the platform. Sure, that's a possibility. Is it because they are on drugs in training and coming off during competition? Yes, that's a possibility as well. So could it be, you know, poorly designed training, hard weight cuts, mental issues? Yes. Sure. Could it be being on drugs and coming off? Yes. It's probably some combination of the first three or just the last one. And, you know, the more often it happens, the more you have to think, like, man, can they not figure out that they shouldn't be cutting so much weight? Or can they not figure out how to peak? Or can they not figure out, like, how to stop being a head case on the platform? So as that goes on more and more, you know, I draw my own conclusions about it, certainly. If you see someone producing these great training results and then they are not at the competition or don't compete at all, but maybe they sign up for meets or say, I'm going to do this meet, and then don't do it, man, that's going to be pretty telling. Like, if you have someone who's strong and seems like they have the ability to be very successful in the sport, and then they don't compete in it, but they kind of feign that they are competitors in it.
Classic.
Yeah, there's...
It's pretty obvious what's going on there. Yeah. If you're lifting numbers that are comparable to your international competitors in a sport that's extremely challenging, like weightlifting or powerlifting, there's no reason why you wouldn't compete. Yeah. Unless you know that when you clean up, you're not going to do as well, or you're just that big of a pussy that you can't compete. Yeah. In which case, I guess, like, whatever.
If you do things,
it's so rare.
If you do things like post, you know, let's talk about weightlifting in America. You know, I look at American weightlifting as it is intrinsically clean. Like, the assumption is that the athletes are clean. They're being drug tested. Are some of them beating it? Sure. Is it as many people as the Jason Blahas of the world would like you to believe? Fuck no. So the implication of the sport is that it is clean because all the competitors are drug tested and there is no, you know, other outlet for them. So people who do weightlifting in America, whether they do it at meets or they post about it online, you know, are giving the implication that they are clean, unless they're just like outright about it, which really none of them are. So if someone is trying to give the suggestion that they are clean by doing weightlifting, and then let's say they sign up for a competition, they are on the start list for a national meet, and then to go a step beyond that, that they're at the meet. They are there in attendance at the venue. And then to go a step beyond that, they don't compete, but let's say, let's theorize,
hypothetically, that maybe
they go in the training hall simultaneous to when they should be competing in the meet, and then they max out. But they, so they're clearly not injured, and it wasn't a scheduling conflict because they're there, and they intended to compete because they, well, they went through the process of signing up, but then they don't actually compete. That is so frustrating to me because it would be one thing to not sign up and just to lift the weights on Instagram. But to go through all that process to give the illusion to people that yeah, I'm there, I'm going to do the meet, so I'm implicitly clean within that, is so disingenuous. Yes. and just shitty.
It is. It's on the same plane as like multi-ply powerlifting level of like lack of character. Yeah. It's obvious. I mean, if you could do it, you would do it, right? Yeah.
Well, like, or if there's training results for people that are impressive and they post about in it, you know, this equals an IPF world record, blah, blah, blah. Can't wait to see them do it in competition. But then more than a year passes and there's no competition results from that person, and then maybe the exact same post resurfaces with the exact same caption, and the last line is still, can't wait to see him do it in competition. Well, when a whole fucking year has passed and you're still saying can't wait to see him do it in competition, using old, at least put goddamn TBT.
You think that post could be used again?
I'm sure it will be. I need to put some alert on it so I can see it again. The anniversary of it. So, I guess we got a little bit off topic of the question there, but physical characteristics, sure. Yeah, those are probably...
That's a slippery slope, though. I would say it's a tough one to gauge, because the strength and the drugs are not necessarily as obvious, whereas, like... Yeah.
The physical characteristics need to be pretty egregious.
Yeah.
It's not going to be these subtle things. But looking at performance results, performance trends...
Yeah.
You know, people in powerlifting that I think, you know, come to mind as drug-free athletes... producing these tremendous results. Jesse Norris, Ray Williams.
Yeah.
I have not, you know, in my powerlifting career, competing all untested, but also being around the you know, USAPL and IPF, I have never had a time where I seriously question the legitimacy of either Jesse Norris or Ray Williams' results. And it's I can tell you it's not an ego thing. So many people, they say that people like that are on drugs because they can't understand.
Yeah.
They want to create an excuse of why they're so much better than them. So it must be drugs. They must be on drugs and lying about it and find some sort of moral superiority in that. I have no problem saying that I take drugs to do powerlifting and Ray Williams lifts more weight than me because he's just fucking stronger. Because like, he's an incredibly strong person.
Yes.
And I have no qualms about my ego in saying that. So people who are so far below what he's doing, stop fucking thinking that it's you know, he out-squats you by 500 pounds because of steroids. Like, no. He's just fucking stronger.
I will say this one piece of advice, too, is that... And this is actually... Like, the reality is, like, you can just walk around assuming that everyone is on drugs and you're on drugs as well, and then that becomes a moot point. Because somebody could beat you by 100 kilos or whatever in the total, but the reality is, like, if you missed one of your lifts, you can get better, and you can do things totally outside of the idea of drugs. So regardless of what everyone else is doing, you need to, like, focus entirely on making yourself better, because there's always room for improvement. Whether you're on drugs or not, you can get better.
Yeah, and... For people who want to cast aspersions, one of those,
yeah.
Cast aspersions around about, you know, it's like some of these people, it's impossible for them to ever prove that they're clean because they're so strong, their result is so good that the haters of the internet will refuse to think, no matter how many drug tests they pass, that person is clean. So if the only way to prove to someone that you're clean is that you suck at the sport.
Right.
That's the only way people will believe it. Yeah. But trust me, I've seen plenty of USAPL local meet results. People pop positive, and they sucked at the sport. So maybe that doesn't even prove it. But yeah, it's just like it fucked either
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
But
you're damned if you do.
Yeah. All right. So next question from Jamie G. Phillips: what aspects of your strength have transferred best or been most useful in jiu-jitsu? So I've been training jiu-jitsu now a little bit more than a year. Four-stripe white belt, most advanced beginner there is at this point. And I'd say, you know, of a couple things to keep in mind here. When I started jiu-jitsu, I'd had about 9 months of very low training. So I was not nearly as strong. You know, I was not my powerlifting peak self. And then showed up to jiu-jitsu the next day. I was much, much weaker. It's probably only been the last month or two where I began to approach, sort of the bottom end of my powerlifting strength, barbell strength, and training jiu-jitsu simultaneously. So maybe this isn't, as complete an understanding as it could be. But I would say that it's very low point of diminishing returns for maximal strength as it transfers to jiu-jitsu. That, like, our head professor, Philippe de la Monica, is 5'8", 170 pounds. I used to do his strength and conditioning training, and he was one of the stronger guys of a very elite group of jiu-jitsu athletes that I trained, but is not strong by any stretch in the powerlifting sense of things, but roll with him and he feels incredibly strong because grip strength, that's going to have a tremendous carryover. So much of lifting heavy barbells is about relatively explosive strength, but concentric, eccentric movement, or so much of the jiu-jitsu stuff is about strength endurance and isometric strength. So grip strength, that's got a huge carryover. Training last night, once I grab someone's collar, they're going to have a really hard time breaking it because my hands have held on to, 400-pound farmer's walks, 800-pound deadlifts, and when I grab their collar, it's going to be tough for them to break. So that's had a big carryover. Yeah, back and hip strength, like in the deadlift, that's certainly useful. I'm never someone who trained my back in terms of like rows and pull-ups, pull-down type of stuff that hard. That's probably something that would have a higher transfer. Core strength and stability, yes, but it's in this, such different positions than supporting a heavy squat or holding a heavy deadlift or even yoke walk, farmer walk type of stuff. I'd say the dynamic nature of yoke and farmers or front carries, that's going to have a pretty good transfer. But yeah, it's so much about strength endurance, which maximal strength develops to a degree. If you can bench 500, you're much more likely to be able to do more reps with 225 than someone who can bench 400. But when shit starts lasting, 5 to 10 minutes in duration, neither of those really matter that much.
It's also a super inefficient way to go about that process, right? Yeah. You'd be better suited developing strength endurance than maximal strength for the same purpose.
Yeah, and then it's hard to tell too for me sometimes because it's like, well, is it because I'm so much stronger in these given positions, or if I'm playing from the top to trying to pass someone's guard, I'm just a shitload heavier than them too, and that's going to play a role. So yeah, I think the grip strength that you can develop, general upper and lower back strength is significant.
You kind of told me the other day that you observed, probably anecdotally, that the guys that were pretty good at bent over rows, you thought that was a pretty solid foundational exercise, or
From a very small sample size, I had a 3 years where I was training maybe 12 black belts on a consistent basis, and very well known jiu-jitsu athletes like Hamalu Bahao, Kyron Gracie, Philippe Pena, who many people regard as the best grappler in the world right now, back when he was a purple belt. I trained him before Worlds at purple belt and then Worlds at brown belt, where he would come from Brazil, people like Victor Estima, a lot of really high-level athletes, with Romulo being the most prolific of them. And, you know, they were... None of them were, like, outstanding in any barbell exercise. Romulo was a good deadlifter, a 495 deadlift for a guy who's was walking around about 195 pounds. But for how much, you know, that he was definitely the standout jiu-jitsu practitioner in that group, all of them were pretty tightly grouped on most exercises, but the deadlift and the bent over row is where he seemed to really separate himself from the rest. And so, again, very, very small sample size and totally anecdotal idea of, like, dynamic correspondence. But I do think that both of those exercises would have maybe a little bit higher transfer, as well as different, like, twisting exercises, like a barbell Russian twist. Though that's a bit harder to quantify because no one has a barbell Russian twist max that they talk about.
I mean, you've got a 5-rep max.
I know the transfer of 150
rotational ab exercises.
Those exercises, you know, the squat, which definitely my best lift as a powerlifter is the squat. And there's a lot of factors to consider in this, but I don't find that it has a very high transfer in to jiu-jitsu, like playing an open guard, getting your feet on the hips. Because for me, my legs are so big and so heavy and relatively inflexible by jiu-jitsu standards. I think I'm very mobile by super heavyweight powerlifter standards, but you can't get them in the right position to push anyways. And then it's not just one, you know, I'm not just going to fucking launch someone across the room with that. It's, you have to hold them there for a long time and hold these isometric positions. So it's more those kind of thinner, wiry guys who, even if I get in their open guard, their foot's on my hip or spider guard or something, that I feel like, wow, this guy's legs are very strong in this context. Can they squat 225? Maybe. But it's, you know, there's such trade-offs with the hypertrophy versus just the strength. And a lot of times where, like, you know, fiber typing, someone who's faster twitch is better suited to squat a lot of weight, but worse suited to be able to hold some of these positions for a long time. So if you want to learn more about some of my stuff with jiu-jitsu, you can check out 2 Beers with Chad episodes, Beers with Chad CWS and BJJ, or Beers with Chad combining BJJ and lifting. And you can find both of those, I think, here on the Jug Life feed, as well as the Beers with Chad YouTube or Beers with Chad podcast feed.
Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy. Especially back in the market downturn, I had very, very frustrating experiences using brokers where I felt like they were making money without me making money. So it's really, really nice that Robinhood has no brokerage charges. While other brokers charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees on trading stocks, so you can keep all of your profits. Plus, they have these easy to understand charts, market data, so place a trade in just 4 taps from your phone. Robinhood's web platform also lets you view stock collections, like 100 most popular, depending on the sector that you're most interested in, and you can curate different categories. So it gives you a lot of really interesting feedback to help you learn how to invest better. Robinhood is giving our listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. So you can sign up at juglife.robinhood.com. That's juglife.robinhood.com.
All right, our next question is from twan.la.fam. And he asks, how do you determine the level of an athlete? Is it by how much they can lift or how experienced they are? Both of those factors are certainly important when assessing an athlete. So what is the athlete assessment useful for anyways? Yeah. It's going to inform us about, probably what about what their MEV, their minimum effective volume is, generally what their maximum recoverable volume is probably around, what type of periodization strategy is going to be most appropriate for them, how long of phases they need. So in terms of, 3+1, 4+1, 5+1 paradigms, as well as the proportion of hypertrophy strength and peaking that they'll need. So it's going to inform a lot of things. Strength and experience are definitely both big factors in that, but gender, size of the athlete, lifestyle factors are all going to be really important as well. From just a strength standpoint, you could have someone who's just very, very, gifted genetically. Their muscles are made of the right stuff, so they're maybe very strong, but fairly new to the sport. Even when I started powerlifting, I did my first meet in 2010, squatted 800, bench 462, deadlifted 700. I had only been training for powerlifting for about 5 months. I had been training with weights for 9 years, and I wouldn't have considered myself advanced as in terms of powerlifting training. I'd say that I had advanced talent. I was an intermediate with advanced talent, that I didn't need to do some of the things that I would consider important for more advanced lifters, like longer taper, greater modulation or undulation of loading to help manage fatigue, even though I had strength numbers that indicated that, because my experience was a bit lower. You could have someone with a ton of experience who's not very strong, and that could happen for a number of reasons. It could mean that, they just don't have great genetics or great propensity for strength. So someone like that, even if they've been doing really good training, might still need to do things like, modulate their volume and intensity to greater degrees, have shorter mesocycles, because they're relatively close to their career peak. Or you could have someone who's really experienced and doesn't need to do those things because they've been doing it wrong for a long time. They've been doing shitty training, so they just need to start doing well-designed training to improve. And that's just as a aside, kind of why I think experience in and of itself, kind of in any field, is a very poor indicator of expertise.
Absolutely.
Can longevity be important? Yes. And if I had two people with relatively similar resumes in whatever field, the one with more experience is probably a better choice. But just doing something for 30 years doesn't make you good at it, because you could be doing it shitty the whole time.
Absolutely. I can think of a couple different examples where I had an athlete, when I worked with Chrissy Hawkins, she came in with basically zero experience in powerlifting, but an entire career of professional bodybuilding, and had, what you would consider in the beginning a low level of qualification for powerlifting, but a very high trainedness and a very high level of muscularity, which contributed to a faster rise in results. And then other situations where you have the opposite. Somebody who has when we work with some lifters from the OTC, people that would come in with a dismal level of general strength, but a very high result in the sport. And so you have two situations, both lifters with lots of experience, totally different scenarios. So just assessing the lifter's qualification based on their total or based on the outcome of their results isn't going to tell the whole picture. The old Soviet system of classification worked really well for them because they had a standardized system of development from the beginning. So you could look at a master of sport and say, we know that a master of sport has accomplished X number of thousands of reps in powerlifting or weightlifting prior to this point, and their total represents that. You could have today somebody walk in the gym possibly and could be a master of sport qualification. Ray Williams, very, very low training volume, but but he's, you know, the highest qualified raw powerlifter ever, probably.
Yeah, and that goes, there was another question kind of to this effect about masters. You know, it was, what's the best program for a master to gain strength? There's no answer. I'm not going to give you an answer. If I told you this is the best program for all 45-year-olds just because you're 45, I would be lying to you. There are people who will try and tell you answers like that, and they're lying to you whether they know it or not.
Absolutely.
So that's why you have to look at the whole picture. You know, both Max and I, you know, are a fan of cougary women. So, you know, Max's wife, Joanne, is 48 years old. Marissa is 42 years old. If we were to line up, you know, 10 other 42-year-old women and 10 other 48-year-old women and see how similar their training could be or should be to Marissa and Joanne's, it probably wouldn't be very similar at all.
No, not even close.
Because their training history is so much different. But Marissa's only been competing in powerlifting for, like, 6 years.
Yeah.
But prior to that, she had, you know, a decade and a half of, or well, it's 2 decades of bodybuilding type of training very, very consistently. And Joanne, you know, from college track to all these other endeavors, has a lot of training history. So you got to look at the whole picture, you know.
Yeah.
Gender, biological age, training age, experience, and what that experience is made up of, strength, lifestyle factors, all of those things are going to help determine the needs for the athlete. Conveniently, just a few days from now, I will release a book called The Powerlifting Program Design Manual, which is going to explain how to take all of these factors and how they should inform programs for powerlifting, the implications of all of these individual differences. So look for that coming out on Thanksgiving. It'll be pre-sale pricing for a couple days, then early bird pricing for a couple days, so be on the lookout for that. To finish off this question, weightlifting presents some unique considerations in regards to technique, how you determine the level of the athlete. Max, what are some of those?
The biggest one for technique is one, obviously, execution of lift correctly, and then stabilization of technique. If you got a lifter that has inconsistent, incorrect technique, then, you know, I think we kind of already determined the idea and defined the idea that training qualification or athlete qualification is an individual thing that is a multitude of factors combined together. But technique and solidification of technique also factor into that. Super strong lifter who has extremely inconsistent technique, it doesn't really matter what their qualification is because they're incapable of executing the technique. If their technique is extremely inconsistent and not solidified, meaning that it just changes regularly, again, a situation where that's a factor in what their training should reflect, you know, their qualification may be very high, they may be strong, but they're incapable of executing the lift. So technique does play a huge role in it. It does play a big factor in training or in, athlete qualification, but it's probably more of a prerequisite that those things have to be stabilized first before training can really take full effect.
Yeah. So the last thing I'll say there is, if you want to learn more about that, I believe it is a Jug Life episode that we did with Dr. Mike Israetel called Training and Nutrition Considerations for Beginners. So look into that one and we talk a bit more about it. Next question comes from Dave Powerlifts. Said the web is packed with 12-week programs. I understand you guys plan longer blocks for your athletes. So what do you think is the optimal length for training blocks before or including peaking? Do you usually prescribe 4 or 5 or 6 month programs? And does the powerlifting club and AI take this into consideration, or are they 12-week programs? And we'll kind of combine that with the last question from Agent21 EMH. How do you plan longer term for an important meet like IPF Worlds, the U.S. Open, or, you know, IWF Worlds that requires a substantial peak? So it's going to go kind of hand in hand with the athlete assessment that we just talked about in the last question. you know, how long a training block is appropriate is going to be determined by the athlete who is doing the training, as well as the competition calendar. It's very, very rare that I get to write a six months of training towards one competition without another competition in between. And, you know, for Max, like working with, let's say, Alyssa Ritchie right now through the in the 2020 Olympic qualifying process, she's got 7 meets she'll probably do this year.
It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, five to 7 meets that she'll do in 2019. So that long-term training becomes that much more complex. So, you know, we definitely don't write 12-week programs for the sake of writing 12-week programs. Is that kind of a nice average time? Sure. You know, some things that I've noticed that I tend to make shorter programs for the more advanced a lifter is, the stronger they are because they accumulate fatigue faster. Too long of sort of a focused training program could, you know, open it up to maybe a bit more injury. So people like Andy Huang, Brandon Allen, we started going to shorter and shorter meet preps, maybe down to like 10 weeks of really focused training directed at the competition. Now, that's not to say that they're just doing whatever the fuck they want in between, but it's less structured.
In their case, too, do you think because they both possess, especially in Andy's case, just such significant amounts of hypertrophy, that portion of the training program is just a very small percentage of the total cycle length?
Yeah.
And in addition to that, the nature of the big weights they're lifting are so much more stimulative that you know, you don't need 16 weeks of squatting in the 700s and 800s to get stronger. And the potential negative side effect is that there's so much fatigue accumulated from those loads, and the potential for injury is higher.
Exactly, to all of that. So in terms of finding an optimal length training block, I'd say the less experienced, less advanced athlete can do well with a longer block. And this is physiological and psychological. When someone's been doing powerlifting for a year, you know, they're so gung-ho and fired up that adhering to a more rigid program for 20 weeks... And that may be, you know, 8 weeks of hypertrophy, 8 weeks of strength, and 4 weeks of peaking is pretty feasible. If I try to give, you know, myself, and I've fallen into this trap in my own training, or try to do that with a really high level lifter, as everyone will and should find in their powerlifting career, the longer you do it, the more sick of it you get. So
The pause before that statement. I knew exactly what he was going to say. So good.
It just becomes like so, it just grinds on you mentally, let alone physically, to do that long of organized training. You need more breaks, because when you do ramp up and train really hard, it's that much more demanding on every part of your being to do so. So, and as you become more experienced, you can do less structured training, you know, things that I'm not including in this training block, like specific preparation for a meet, and still be relatively successful with it because you just have a deeper understanding of the training process, of your body, of how you respond, about, you know, how good or bad you really feel at a given time. So that takes me to, like, training for Marissa as she prepares for IPF Worlds. She did nationals 6-7 weeks ago, won her 4th straight USAPL national title, and is now, you know, into week 5 of her training plan for Worlds. But our specific, like, training, like, this is the training to prepare you for the meet. Yeah, it's all part of it, but it's how specific that is in nature is having huge variance. We're basically 6 weeks of no barbell squatting or deadlifting to give her sciatica issue time to heal, to give her mind and body a break from that type of training. You know, and a lesser experienced athlete might think, I can't not squat or deadlift for 6 weeks. I'm going to get weak. But we know that there's not any, you know, we don't have to be 26 weeks out from competition and ready to do a PR. You only had to be ready to do a PR the day of the competition. So she's going to go 6 weeks of you know, this very general training that's loosely structured. Like, she has a lot of flexibility in what she does from day to day on it, just so she feels good. You know, she's lifting, she's being active, she's being athletic. But we got plenty of time after that. Then we'll go into 6 weeks of more focused work capacity development, still with, you know, a looser structure, but at least the overarching, you know, theme of it is we're going to do more and more and more with a lot of variation, develop a really broad base. Then it'll be 8 weeks of hypertrophy, again, fairly non-specific to powerlifting, you know, in depending on what sense you think of that as, when you're as advanced as she is, and world champion, all that stuff. The spectrum of general to specific is narrowed quite a bit, but doing leg press for sets of 10 to 15 is pretty general compared to one rep max, you know, back squatting. So she'll do that for 8 weeks and then move into about a 10-week meet prep, you know, really focused. All right, this is when we're going to get good at powerlifting. So all that stuff has value. Would a less experienced lifter be able to succeed with the same type of structure? No, it probably wouldn't be appropriate for them. But you know, working in GPP blocks and stuff is certainly worthwhile. You can check out Beers with Chad episodes about that. One, I think, is called Putting the G in Your PP. and one of them is called My Biggest Powerlifting Mistake. And I talk about both of those things in there.
Something that I think is really important to understand about training block length and training cycle length is that it's not an arbitrary amount of time that you decide based on how you feel you're going to train. And something that Chad outlined in what he was describing with Marissa is that as the training becomes less specific, it is more, in his words, loose, in that the decisions made about training, as in exercise selection, you know, training method, they're less critical in their choices. Marissa could pick any number of different push-up calisthenic variations in this 5-week training that's basically off-season for her. None of them are going to have any significant impact in terms of a negative result in her powerlifting total. As the training cycle, as the training blocks progress from less specific to more specific, those training decisions become more critical to the point that, you know, the meat prep, like he talked about with Andy, you know, and his other strong lifters, like, those are really critical decisions that need to be exact and are dialed in, because we have effective enough methods now to train and get exactly the result you want. There's no guesswork in Andy Huang's program going into a meet, because you can't guess and screw around and be wrong with somebody who's doing that many, or, you know, in Chad's case, that many 800 plus pound squats on a regular basis. You know, those decisions have to be accurate and correct. And the cycle length and block length has to reflect the result that you're trying to get at the end of it. You know, just picking a 16-week hypertrophy block is pointless if you're Andy Huang. It's just not necessary. And then the same for Marissa, right? As the cycle progresses, those decisions become more and more dialed in, more and more important, and then cycle length and block length reflect that, you know, accurately.
So when you're dealing with these really short preparations, for Alyssa particularly, because the qualification process is so demanding, what are some things you take into account when it's, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks to get ready?
The biggest things we have to take into account is what meets we're planning on peaking at and what meets we're going to plan on doing our absolute best at. And a lot of that is determined primarily by the qualification process. Scoring Roby points at international meets is a higher priority than being at your absolute peak at those meets early in the quad, right? Because if you don't have points, if you bomb or you make mistakes, you lose out on big time things you could get at gold meets, where you get an extra multiplier on the points. In local meets and qualifying for world teams, it's important to be in excellent shape because if you don't make the team, you're out, you're shit out of luck. If you don't get on the world team and you don't make points there, your qualification is basically over. So at this point, the primary focus is on ensuring that we're on teams, so our focus is on preparing for those. Her training has changed a little bit to be at a slightly higher intensity on a little bit in a little bit shorter cycles, like you said with Andy, where we're basically gearing up for this meet. It's not going to be 100% peak or 100% best shape here, but we're still at relatively high intensity and relatively close to peak shape so that we can actually perform. Then the next meet, whether it's a meet we can take easy or a meet we have to peak for, we adjust training that way. The unfortunate aspect of having that many qualifying procedures is that there's very little time for recuperation after big meets, and there's very little time to do any kind of general work because we have to be back in peak shape pretty quickly.
Yeah, and to the people who may be listening and think like, well, the way that I train, like I'm always ready for competition. You're not always peaked by doing that. In fact, you're never peaked by doing that. You're constantly plateaued.
Yeah.
And some days you might have a good day and lift well, and some days you might not, but it's not with the directed nature that phasic training, building up to a peak and having general phases is going to be. So last thought on this question is, does the club stuff and the AI take this into consideration? Well, the club powerlifting does not exist anymore. People who are in the club are continuing to do it, but you can't sign up for it anymore. So the AI coaching, yes, the AI coaching takes everything into consideration. It is as much detail as I talk about training in these videos and everything. It's all of that all the time.
So it's like Rain Man.
Yeah, it doesn't get tired. It doesn't wake up hungover on a Sunday when it's time to write programs. Like, oh, how about a deload? it's taking everything into consideration all the time. So you tell it, this is when my meet is, and that could be 5 weeks out or it could be 50 weeks out. And if it is a really long time, it's going to give you longer hypertrophy phases, most likely, depending on what you put in for body weight goals and that kind of stuff. And it would bring you to a peak in between that, because it's not just going to have a 50-week meet training. It will bring you to a peak before that, just to really see how you respond to some of that, so it can make it better for you the next time when it matters. But there's no set program length in it. So you could get a 12-week program if you tell it that you're 12 weeks out for a meet. But it's thinking very complexly about that, about unique needs of the lifter based on their goals, their competition calendar, their strength, their experience, their size. All of these things are going to change the phase proportion and phasic structure.
I like to think of it like that scene in Terminator 2 when Arnold walks into the bar naked and he looks at the guy and it like sizes up his clothes. Well, that's what I envision every time I hear AI.
We're going to be recreating that scene soon enough. Let me get my RP diet app going a little bit more before I go, full nude on camera. But what about club weightlifting? What's the typical...
The typical cycle length is generally around 12 weeks, 8 to 12 weeks, just depending on when the actual meets are. I try to plan them around in big competitions, less so peaking for things like nationals, AO finals, because I think a lot of people that are on the club weightlifting are generally shooting for AO series meets. So we plan for those, but we do plan to peak at those meets, and it's basically just the time frame between them.
All right, so that's about it. Make sure, thanks for asking questions. Those of you who asked good ones, so some of you who asked really shitty ones, have you ever watched our YouTube? All the answers are there. Like I said, in a couple days, powerlifting program design manual will be out. All kinds of specials for Black Friday, Cyber Monday. They'll really run, most of them running Thursday, Thanksgiving, through the following Tuesday. So look for that. There'll be sales on apparel, on books, on templates, all kind of stuff. And again, the new book, Powerlifting Program Design Manual. the AI coaching, ton of people are using it, getting really good feedback on it so far. It is in the beta stage, so you can get in at the lowest price it will ever be and help us make it the best. And you get locked in at that price for the duration of your membership. So check that out. We have a bunch of videos on YouTube, podcast episodes talking about what it is, how it does what it does. Upcoming events on Thanksgiving, I will open up registration for all of my clinics for the first half of the year. You will know exactly where I am going for clinics throughout the entire year. So you will not have to ask me, when are you coming to blah, blah, blah place? When are you coming to my backyard to do a clinic for me? Because the whole schedule will be there, and that's all the places I'm going to go. So through the first half of the year, I will be in Oakland, Salt Lake City, Athens, Georgia, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Indianapolis, Indiana, and New York. So check out those clinics. You can register for them beginning on Thanksgiving. Max, I know you will be in Germany for some clinics.
Germany and Dublin in the end of January, January 20th, I believe.
All right. So Europe, be on the lookout there. If you like the podcast, go on iTunes, write us something funny or nice, leave us a 5-star review. We always appreciate that. Subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the YouTube, share it with your friends who want to learn more about this stuff. And where can they find you?
You can find me, Max_Ada, on Instagram or Facebook, Max Ada, or you can email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you for listening. This is the Jug Life Podcast. We'll talk to you next week.